Welcome to Franchise Festival, where we go in-depth with noteworthy video game series from the last 40 years. For Season 5, we're working through BioWare's Mass Effect. Be sure to let us know what you think by emailing franchisefestival@gmail.com or reaching out through our website at patreon.com/franchisefestival. As for us, we're your hosts, Chris.
And I'm Hamilton.
And today, we'll be discussing the development and gameplay generalities of Mass Effect 3 before walking through Mass Effect 2's Arrival DLC, which serves as something of a prologue for its sequel. So let's talk about development. Key staff, there's not a lot to remark upon here. Casey Hudson is once again the director, as he had been for Mass Effect 2. One major shakeup that Lily had referred to when she guested on some of our Mass Effect 2 episodes was that Drew Karpyshyn, who had written Mass Effect 1 in its entirety and co-wrote Mass Effect 2, was gone and had begun working on BioWare's MMO, The Old Republic, at this time. Our loss, because, he provided a lot of the coolest sci-fi details of Mass Effect 1 and 2. But in his place is truly another talented writer, Mac Walters, who had co-written Mass Effect 2 with Karpyshyn. So there is continuity there, but you can see the move away from harder sci-fi and towards more blockbuster, emotionally driven sci-fi for Mass Effect 3. The lead composer of Mass Effect 1 and 2, Jack Wall, is similarly gone, and he's been replaced with a whole team. I'm going to get some of these names bad, so, you know, just brace yourself, listeners. Sasha Dekikian, Sam Hulick, Christopher Lenertz, Clint Mansell, and Chris Velasco. Now, all of those folks had contributed to previous Mass Effect games, aside from Mansell, but here the soundtrack was split up among them without having that guidance of Jack Wall. And consequently, the music was planned to incorporate both synthesizer-style compositions in the style of Mass Effect 1, as well as orchestral compositions in the style of Mass Effect 2. I don't know about you, Hamilton. I had not noticed when playing them that Mass Effect 2 was so much more orchestral. But then when I went back and listened to the soundtracks, I was like, oh yeah, Mass Effect 1 has that like 80s sound and Mass Effect 2 has more of a 2000s sound.
You know, it's funny. I didn't pay that close attention to the sounds of the music. I mean, they fit the like the feel of the gameplay, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like, it adds drama to every scene and things like that, but I didn't really see the nuances of, like, oh, this has more orchestra, or oh, this has more, like, synthetic, like, beats to it. So, that's interesting. I have to go back and listen.
Yeah, it is kind of curious. Once you go back, and I should have noticed, because I put all of those sound clips in for our 8 episodes on the 2 games so far, so... You know, it should have come to my attention. I will say that the Mass Effect 1 episodes were more fun to put sound clips into because I like the synthesizer sound more. And Mass Effect 2, I did notice once I thought about it, I was like, yeah, there's a lot more like kind of meandering strings. It's a little more like John Williams or something.
Exactly. It fit well enough. So I was like, okay.
The only song that always stands out in my mind for these games is that song when you go into the galaxy map. Where it's like boop 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 boop.
Oh
boop,
yeah.
Boop, boop. I think I've been using that song for after the intro for every one of our Mass Effect episodes because I like it so much.
It is kind of chill.
Yeah, exactly. It sets the tone. One other big change here is that Microsoft Game Studios was no longer the publisher and key creative partner on the project, which meant that BioWare could plan the game for all modern hardware simultaneously. As we'll see, whereas the first two games were very geared towards the Xbox, this time it launched simultaneously across Xbox, PC, and PlayStation 3. With regard to the development process, it began just before Mass Effect 2 wrapped in late 2009, early 2010, and was planned to take 2 years. I really appreciate that BioWare, when setting out, once they had decided to make Mass Effect a trilogy, wanted to ensure that the whole trilogy could be played on a single console generation. The intended release was late 2011, and the team aimed to synthesize what worked from each of the previous games and remove what didn't. So fans had expressed wanting more RPG elements. They felt that too much of that had been stripped away in Mass Effect 2. But they also wanted the stronger action set pieces of Mass Effect 2, because those were more exciting than the comparatively like clunky action of Mass Effect 1. So they were trying to bring all of that together. They entirely threw out the vehicle sections from Mass Effect 1 that also weren't present in Mass Effect 2, as well as the planet mining from Mass Effect 2, which in interviews the development team said nobody liked. I take exception to that. I kind of like the planet mining. I think you kind of like the planet mining, right, Hamilton?
Not at all.
Yeah. Well, since Spencer's not here today, we will blame him for being the fan that doesn't like the planetary mining and so taking it out of the game.
Spencer, how could you?
How could you, Spencer? So one of the interesting things that this aim to integrate Mass Effect 1 and 2 led to was that in the original Mass Effect 3, there are 3 campaign modes that you can choose from. You could play through the game in action mode, where you don't make any dialogue choices, which is absolutely bananas, because that feels like the whole point of these games. But combat difficulty is normal, so this is for players who, you know, want more of a shooter. You could also do story mode, where you do get to select dialogue from the wheel, but the combat difficulty is set down to minimal, so it's very hard to lose combat encounters. This is for folks who obviously want the story, but aren't action gameplay fans. And then last is the combination of those, RPG, where dialogue is selectable and the combat is normal. That's, of course, the default experience. Mm-hmm. I noticed, because you and I are playing this through the Legendary Edition, I noticed that you don't select one of these 3 options when you start the game up anymore. But if you go into the menu while you're playing, you can actually change these on the fly. So you could customize it to be, you can remove the ability to select dialogue options from yourself or set the combat anywhere from like casual to veteran. So, you know, it's more malleable than these modes would have allowed you to do.
It's kind of like, it's interesting that, a recent game I had to do that with the game of the year, Re Fantasio metaphor.
Yeah, right.
I like games that let you change the difficulty as you're playing it, instead of like back in the good old days where you're kind of just stuck with one and hope for the best.
Yeah, you pick it at the beginning with no knowledge of what it means.
Right.
And then you just have to live, you know, you make your bed in those first 2 minutes and then you lie in it for the next 60 hours.
Right. And if you die and die, it's like there's nothing you can do to like make it a more enjoyable experience, so they start adding these things.
Yeah, that's so good and player focused, and it's cool to see I was going to say it's cool to see that that existed all the way back here in 2012 when this game came out, but I guess this is kind of the opposite. The original version of this game routed you into one of those from the start, but the modern version lets you adapt it, so you know, sometime between 2012 and now, I guess people got the message.
Which I appreciate.
I like in Silent Hill games, too, where you can adjust the combat difficulty and the puzzle difficulty. I've never seen any other game do that, but I think that's fun.
That's interesting. I still have to play it.
So one of the main through lines on this project was, as I have here in the notes, bigger, bigger, bigger. Compared to the 20,000 lines of dialogue in Mass Effect 1 and the 25,000 lines of dialogue in Mass Effect 2, Mass Effect 3 has 40,000 lines of dialogue. Twice as much as Mass Effect 1. Now, part of that's because it's longer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Mass Effect 1 is a comparatively short game. But my guess is that most of these lines of dialogue are things that most players won't see because Mass Effect 3 has to adapt to all of the choices that you made in Mass Effect 1 and 2, that, you know, any given scene is going to have 4 or 5 different variations of dialogue. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that the average player will hear more dialogue in the course of their game. It just means that there are more variations on any given scene because those choices build up over the course of the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
That's my speculation. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, definitely good for the voice actors.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I was reading, I don't have this in the notes because I couldn't, the source on it was like a video source that I couldn't access anymore, so I didn't want to put it in here as gospel. Mm-hmm. But BioWare seemed to use some kind of weird voice acting technology for this. Now, of course, you know, listeners in the future, we're recording this in the age of AI ascendance here in the mid-2010s. But that didn't exist back when these games were being made. But they did come up with some kind of proprietary software, since none of the, you know, anytime you've got a dialogue scene in this game, it's not that there were multiple actors on set at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
They all recorded their voice lines in isolation, which makes it incredible that it works so well. And part of the reason why is, and again, I was reading this in a Wikipedia summary, so take it with a grain of salt. If listeners have a better source on this, please send it to us because I'm intrigued. But BioWare had some kind of technology that would flag the intended emotions associated with every line and put them in, like, conversation with the surrounding lines. So anybody doing a reading for the game, any of the actors who were recording it in isolation, would know exactly the emotional tone of every line in the conversation. I thought that was pretty cool.
Interesting.
Moving along to the kind of the combat, the action, battlefields here are wider, more diverse in setting, and more complex. Casey Hudson really wanted a lot of dynamic events, like the battlefield shifting or becoming damaged by surrounding explosions and gunfire, you know, like ships crashing into the battlefield. You see this even in the opening minutes of the game, to keep the combat more engaging than it had been in Mass Effect 2 and make it more similar to something like a Call of Duty or a Battlefield game from when it was coming out. The writing, which of course is what most people are here for, was carried out by Mac Walters primarily. The way that this process worked is that Walters collaborated with the director Hudson to draft a short story outlining all of the major plot points of Mass Effect 3, separate, of course, from all of the choices that you could make. And then that short story was distributed to various co-writers on the project, who were each responsible for a section of the game or a major character arc. And then this team of writers would peer review each other's work to make sure that it was internally consistent over the 2.5 years that they were working on it. So there's this very fun documentary that was made by, I think it's Jeff Keighley, actually, the guy who does the Game Awards now.
Mm-hmm.
He did one of these documentaries for, I think, each of the Mass Effect games, or at least for several other games. I know he did one for Half-Life 2 back at this time. I guess back in the mid-2000s. And then he did one of these called The Final Hours of Mass Effect 3, which is where we get a lot of the development details on Mass Effect 3 from. And one of the chapters on that talks about this staff member at BioWare called Preston Wadomaniak, who was described as Casey Hudson's right-hand guy. And this person's entire role on the project was to basically be an internal superfan. He played through Mass Effect 1 and 2 60 to 70 times each and got himself to the point where he could speedrun the first game in only an hour and 40 minutes. And the reason why they turned to this guy was because he was really good at spotting internal plot inconsistencies that just naturally arise when you're writing for a bazillion different potential outcomes. So he would try to play through these games with every potential outcome of every potential dialogue choice and see where those little rough areas were, those rough edges. The documentary points out one instance of this in Mass Effect 2 where the writing team hadn't actually included a scene that served as a payoff for players who remained faithful to their Mass Effect 1 love interest in Mass Effect 2, because it was just assumed that most players would, you know, have a new love interest in Mass Effect 2. So they just didn't plan for it. And so in, I don't know, his 21st playthrough of Mass Effect 2 or whatever, he noticed that They didn't have a scene for that. So in the final 2 weeks of development on Mass Effect 2, the team added a scene to plug that plot hole. And so I really like that this guy is part of why Mass Effect 3 holds together as well as it does, is that they had him going through and being like, ah, but don't you remember this conversation that somebody had with Rex all the way back in Mass Effect 1? And that's not accounted for here. So he was their super fan on site. I really like it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, you really need that for this kind of project. Usually, yeah. These days, it feels like studios turn to just actual external super fans.
Mm-hmm.
But back at this time, you know, I guess they were willing to pay somebody internally to do that job. Thank goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Wanted to note here that there is a multiplayer component to Mass Effect 3 that we're going to talk about a little bit more down in the generalities. This integrated work from sister studio BioWare Montreal, which had been working on a canceled multiplayer spinoff in 2009 called Mass Effect Team Assault, which would have been a first-person shooter intended to compete with Call of Duty at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why that got scrapped and why Mass Effect hadn't done multiplayer before multiplayer... heaven help me, before Mass Effect 3, is explicated by director Casey Hudson in an interview where he said that he had wanted to have multiplayer for a while, but that because the entirety of the Mass Effect universe at the time was so tied to Commander Shepard, he couldn't come up with a way to justify multiplayer that didn't have you just playing as Commander Shepard. However, with Mass Effect 3 shifting to this wider Galaxy at War setting, they could they could justify a multiplayer component where players are taking part in these battles that are raging all across the galaxy between different factions during the course of this massive war. So this was the opportune time to strike while the iron was hot on that. I will say I think there are some behind the scenes stuff going on with that. EA, which was the publisher for this, as it had been for the earlier Mass Effect games, got really hooked on the idea of online multiplayer at this time, and basically necessitated it for virtually any project that their sub-studios were working on. So, you know, how much of this is Casey Hudson coming up with a way to justify what had been mandated by EA versus what he had actually wanted to do? I don't know. But I guess it doesn't hurt to take him at his word, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So development dragged into a third year. They missed their original deadline, but pressure from the publisher made BioWare finally buckle down and establish a finish line of March 2012 for release. So this led them to scrap or change quite a few details. And I always like these what might have been scenarios. So I wanted to note a few of these in our podcast here. First is that there was a Prothean team member planned for Mass Effect 3, but it couldn't be fully fleshed out during the core development process, so they cut that character. Next is that there was an alternative ending, which Lily talked about a little bit in our Mass Effect 2 episodes, and this alternative ending, which had been planned by the original writer Drew Karpyshyn, would have focused on dark energy and the role that it played in the universe. There's a cool interview where he talks about some of his ideas on this. One of the ideas was that biotics were inadvertently manipulating the dark energy, mortals engaged in biotics, and that worried the immortal Reapers, who were afraid of the universe being turned inside out by dark matter manipulation, and so that is why they were going through and killing off all of these sentient races. That does not end up being the case in the final game, but it was one of the ideas that they had. I do like that, given how controversial the Mass Effect 3 ending would be, that Karpyshyn in the interview says that as much as fans might hear that and think, oh, that would have been so much cooler than what we got, those were only ideas. And by, you know, if they had gone with that ending, it would have changed a lot during the Mass Effect 3 development process. So it probably would have been controversial or disappointing for different reasons. It's not like that would have been the silver bullet to make the series more coherent. Another possible story conclusion that they had in their pocket and didn't use was that Shepard was going to turn out to not be human, but not have known it, not have realized it, have, like, I guess, implanted memories or something. But that was discarded for being too similar to a plot point in Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, which I haven't played, so I can't speak to.
Yeah, same. Heard it's great, though.
Oh, yeah. The port for Switch is incredible. It just it plays like a dream on there. I recommend. I've dabbled in it. You know, I've played a couple hours of it, and the port's really good. But it is very much a PC game from the early 2000s with all that entails.
Ah.
Two other cool late game confrontations that were going to happen that don't end up in the final game is that the elusive man was going to transform into a weird cybernetic creature like Saren and face you in a climactic boss fight. But the team thankfully found this very artificial and gamey and removed it. What we get with the elusive man instead is much better, in my opinion. And lastly, there was going to be a Reaper Queen hidden away deep within the Citadel, who would have offered a final set of choices that determine your ending. But she was removed in favor of the Star Child who appears in the final game. I think a Reaper Queen is kind of a cool idea, but also a very silly idea.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It's kind of a wash. Feels like a lateral move to me.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to its release, Mass Effect 3 finally launched on PlayStation 3, Xbox 360, and Windows PC in March 2012. Followed by one of the more delightful weird little dead ends of the Mass Effect world, a Wii U port of Mass Effect 3, which was published in November 2012. And you might be thinking to yourself, that's funny, Chris. I don't remember hearing you guys talk about a Wii U port of Mass Effect 1 or 2. It seems really problematic to just drop the conclusion of a trilogy on a console, especially a trilogy that hinges so much on players having made consequential choices in the past, without offering you the opportunity to make any of those consequential choices. And I'd say yes, it was an absolutely absurd idea. I've never heard anybody say anything good about this port. I don't know how it performs. But, like, what's the point, you know? How do you play Mass Effect 3 without Mass Effect 1 and 2? It's absurd. Critics were generally pretty positive on Mass Effect 3, lauding it for its story and gameplay, but the ending was very controversial, and at this point takes up most of the space in the room when people talk about Mass Effect 3's launch. A lot of fans took it to task for disregarding their own personal adventures in the ending in favor of routing them into one of three more or less standalone endings that don't hinge on anything that you did earlier. And this led to an extremely weird cultural moment that I remember living through because I had a lot of friends who were Mass Effect fans at the time, where aggrieved Mass Effect players attempted to get BioWare to change the ending of the game via patch because they were so furious. You know, gamers revolt, etc., etc. Fans complained to the FTC in the United States, claiming that BioWare had not delivered what it had promised throughout the series. And an official at the Better Business Bureau even issued a statement that said BioWare had misled players into thinking they would have more of an impact on the plot's outcome than they really did. So, you know, thankfully we didn't get any laws changed due to dissatisfaction with Mass Effect 3. But this whole experience was, I don't know, I don't think this is an original observation, but it feels like this was a grim harbinger of things to come with regard to the misogynistic Gamergate movement of the early 2010s. I guess that was probably about 2 years after this happened. And, you know, the Venn diagram is not a circle. You know, I'm sure there were lots of good faith Mass Effect players who weren't misogynistic weirdos who would take part in Gamergate. And I'm sure there were a lot of misogynistic weirdos who took part in the Gamergate campaign of harassing female journalists who had no interest in Mass Effect. You know, it's, but there is an overlap there. You know, a lot of those techniques were pioneered in this this white hot rage about the Mass Effect 3 ending being a little bit disappointing to some folks.
It's wild. The Federal Trade Commission?
Can you believe it? Yeah. Yeah, I think there was a change.org petition. Remember those? It was a wild time to be alive, the early 2010s. You see, we got a lot of indigestion about our Mass Effect 3 ending.
Oh my gosh.
Truly a simpler time.
Yeah.
All of that being said, Casey Hudson and the BioWare team got enough pressure put on them that they did indeed change the ending for, I think, the first time in a game, or at least the first time that I became aware of this happening, partially due to patches being a thing that you could do in the Xbox 360 and PS3 era. They released an expanded ending for Mass Effect 3 in June 2012. That features a longer epilogue and more explanations for the major events at the story's conclusion. So it doesn't feel like it comes quite out of nowhere as much as players felt that it did in the original ending. I have never seen the extended ending. I played this at release and was done probably by, I don't know, April or May of 2012. And so I am really excited to see the extended ending when we play it for the show.
I'm so curious, because I never played this game, I mean, as we all know, at all.
Right.
Does this have the original ending? Or has it just been painted over?
Yeah, it's been fully painted over. And I don't think anything of value is lost. I mean, I guess I'll find out when I get there, but my understanding is that none of the original ending is removed. It's just expanded on.
Okay.
So, you know, an enterprising fan could just keep their eyes closed and wear some earmuffs or something during the extra bits and get the experience of playing the original ending.
Interesting.
Yeah, in full disclosure, I didn't mind the original ending. It was, you know, disappointing a bit, but golly, like, media literacy is a thing. And if you get to the conclusion of a long-running trilogy, and you assume it's going to wrap up really well and, like, answer all your questions and everything, I don't know. Like, that never happens. It's like the Game of Thrones ending, you know, people bemoan, and with good cause. Like, it's got a lot of problems. But also, there was no way that was going to end in a way that was satisfying for me as a longtime fan, right? You know, you just kind of build that into your experience of a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's so rare that a long-running story ends in a satisfying manner, because it has to be too many things to too many people.
Right.
So, you know, you just kind of absorb it and move on.
It's too much. It's too beloved. It's like...
Exactly.
People really don't want it to end. They do, but they don't. Right. So it's just like... The ending is just going to feel disappointing, kind of like a stab to the heart, because it's just like, oh, this is my favorite, whatever, show, and now it's ending, and this is all we can come up with. This has got to be tough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too much pressure to put on a writer. I mean, shoot, Stephen King's never written a good ending in his life, and everybody loves him. you know, the same people who come up with, like, really good ideas and developments in stories aren't always the same people who can write a great ending. And I think that's one of the reasons that the middle part of a trilogy is almost always the coolest one, because it doesn't have the burden of exposition or ending. Last but not least here, this game got a lot of downloadable content, like its predecessor, and a lot of it's really cool. A lot of it is stuff that I haven't played yet, which I'm excited to play for the show. These all came out within the year after Mass Effect 3 released. So you've got From Ashes, which actually came out on the day that Mass Effect 3 released. It was like a pre-order bonus. But that incorporates the Prothean squadmate who had been planned for the game, Javik. So he joins your squad and you get a whole bunch of story with him. That is one of my favorite subplots of Mass Effect 3. So I'm really grateful they were able to add him in as DLC. Other DLC packages include Leviathan, which explores the origins of the Reapers. I haven't played that and I'm looking forward to it. Omega, where Shepard assists Arya T'Lok in her reconquest of the junk planet Omega. And then lastly, Citadel, where Shepard and their crew hang out on the Citadel prior to the final Reaper assault. That is widely beloved and regarded as something of a true ending to Mass Effect 3. Mm-hmm. I know regular listener Jerathan, if memory serves, really likes that DLC and has been telling me to play it for years. Mm-hmm. So you're going to get your wish, buddy. I'm finally going to play it for the show.
So gameplay, if you've played Mass Effect 1 and 2, the story will carry over from that based on the save file that you have on the console.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similar to if you played Mass Effect 2 like I did.
Yeah.
God damn it. I had a good point and I lost it.
I'll fix it in post.
There we go. So if Shepard survived, oh, can he die in Mass Effect 2?
Yes, Spencer Shepard died, right?
Did he?
No, you know, I'm combining it because Spencer made his Shepard a different character in Mass Effect 2 because, you know, after the events at the start of that game. I don't think his Shepard died at the end of Mass Effect 2. Things have to go hilariously wrong for Shepard to die at the end of Mass Effect 2. Like, you mm-hmm. need to, you basically need to, like, speed run the game and not do any loyalty missions. You really need to run the game into the ground to get Shepard to die at the end.
You have
but
to
it
try
can
to die.
Happen.
Okay.
Exactly. And I have no earthly idea what happens if Shepard dies at the end of Mass Effect 2. I guess I should look that up. Listeners, if you know or you have any experience with that, please tell us. Because I really want to know, like, do you yeah. just get, is it like Shepard's brother joins the cast? I don't know.
Maybe that was the whole, like, Shepard was an alien thing. Or not human.
Yeah, it turns out Shepard's just a title. You know, they hire somebody new to go on trial at the beginning of Mass Effect 3, and they just call them Shepard and attribute all of Shepard's crimes to them, you know?
He's like, oh, I don't sure, know. I guess I'm in now.
Yeah, I have no idea what happens if Shepard dies, but yes, if Shepard survives Mass Effect 2, which happens in 95% of players' experiences, they can be imported into Mass Effect 3 with those stats and abilities that they had in the previous game.
Also, many characters in this game will be alive or dead. Based on what you did in Mass Effect 1 and 2.
Mm-hmm.
One of the base examples, and the one that I was happy with personally, is Arachne Queen.
Yeah.
I spared her, so I'm very excited to see her come back, because I didn't think she deserved to die. Rex, which I tried very hard to keep alive, and he is indeed alive in mine.
Woo.
And Samara, who she is also alive.
I think Lily told us that if Samara, because you can... If you play your cards right, you can side with Samara's daughter in her loyalty mission and get Samara killed.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, her daughter is here instead of her, but their plots are actually pretty different because Samara's daughter turns into like a weird indoctrinated monster or something, whereas Samara doesn't. So that can actually articulate very differently. I don't know what happens if the Rachni Queen is not still alive. Mm-hmm. Do you remember if Spencer dumped it? Didn't Spencer kill the Rachni Queen?
He did, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess we'll get to find out.
Yeah. But in any case, and there's probably many other examples.
Yeah.
And if they didn't survive, like Chris said, they'll just be replaced by less interesting stand-ins.
Mm-hmm.
But they gotta fill the plot somehow.
Yeah, sometimes it works better. Like with Rex, there's just a different Krogan that took over as the leader of the Erdnot clan, which works pretty well. But like with the Rachni Queen, I like to picture that there's like a Rachni King that nobody talked about.
Rachni King. The Rachni Prince.
Yeah, he just got shipped in from a neighboring galaxy.
You know, he just heard.
Some of them. Yeah. Some of the substitutes work better than others.
Yeah. Like all the other games, it's a third person shooter.
Mm-hmm.
So fan criticisms of Mass Effect 2 led the team to integrate some more RPG elements.
Yeah.
But this is ultimately the least traditional RPG in the series.
Yeah, this is basically just an over-the-shoulder shooter. Like, this is as close as the series would come to, I don't know, Gears of War? I was about to say Winback, which would have been an amazing pull for the third-person shooter that everybody fondly remembers from the Nintendo 64. But no, Gears of War is probably a better point of comparison.
I find the criticism fact kind of interesting, too, because like I thought the second one was pretty streamlined. I mean, I guess, okay, to be super, super fair, if not a little nitpicky, a lot of the abilities were kind of samey to me. I will admit that it didn't really feel like every character's abilities were unique.
Mm-hmm.
The personalities felt unique, but their abilities are like, eh. I mean, oh, right. This one also can get a drone. Okay.
Drones for everybody.
Drone for you. Drone for you.
Oprah's giving out drones.
That's what Shepard does. If this is actually Shepard, not an alien.
Yeah. False Shepard.
Oh my God. How cool would that be, though?
I meant to tell you, you know, we didn't talk about it in the development section, and I'm not going to give it much airtime here, but there's this whole fan theory called indoctrination theory that I recommend looking up sometime. Don't look it up until you finish this game, both Hamilton and listeners, because it will spoil the end of the game. But once you finish the game, look up the indoctrination fan theory, because it's some really wacky kind of fan fiction stuff about ideas about Shepard being indoctrinated. It's just kind of zany.
I wonder the ending is so bad because he's a false shepherd.
Exactly. That's
he led you down the wrong way.
Yep. It was all a dream.
Let me untangent myself. One additional customization feature is weapon modifications.
Yeah.
I guess it's kind of similar to the first one.
Exactly. Like in the first one, you could graft a mod onto your weapon.
Yeah.
The big difference here is that they aren't consumable. So, like, once you get a mod, it can be applied to anybody's weapon and everybody's weapon simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
They're just, they're little upgrades that you can apply, but they, you know, you don't get, like, scope 6 for this character and, I don't know, heat sink 1 for this character.
Oh, God, that was awful.
I know. Do you remember those menus?
Oh, yeah, Lord. I remember the menu, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I can appreciate, you know, the skeleton of what Mass Effect would become, but...
Right.
I'm glad they updated that one.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't go back to the Mass Effect 1 menus.
Weapons can also be upgraded to new ranks, which again, like ME1, but far better, because in ME1, you couldn't upgrade them, I believe.
Yeah.
You just had to collect higher quality guns, so you just have like 10 trillion just crappy weapons.
Yeah, which of my 23 pistols will I break out for this encounter?
Exactly.
They all differ by 0.001% in their range and power.
Again, won't talk too much. I get it. The starting point, fair is fair. But yes, this will make things much easier.
Mm-hmm.
As regards to combat, moving into cover and over obstacles is much quicker and snappier.
Mm-hmm.
Gameplay is a lot more punchy, too.
Yeah, did you notice that, like, when you try to go over an obstacle, you get, like, a little, like, a transparent arrow that shows you where your character's gonna go? I really like it.
Yes. And I also noticed that the gunfights are a little bit more fun. That was another thing that I think both ME1 and ME2 suffered a bit.
Yeah.
Is that everything is bullet spongy to the point where it doesn't, like, feel dramatic.
Right.
You're just kind of holding down the shoot button and you're just hoping for the best.
Yeah, it's like a Final Fantasy VI encounter, which, like, is fine for that game, but doesn't integrate well with the, like, the aesthetics and the feel of a third-person shooter. They really found their stride here.
Yeah. Like, one game that, like, still feels good to play, and it's very interesting I got back, sit my back into it, or at least, like, revisit it, Gears of War.
Yeah, that's a good punchy shooter
experience. It's a good punchy shooter game. It feels good to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
We now also have a heavy melee attack that requires a charge up. I might be on the fence on when it comes to melee attack in your shooter games. I both appreciate it and don't. One big example, let's say, is like RE6, Resident Evil 6.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Yeah, listeners, if you want to hear our tight 6 hours on Resident Evil 6, you can go back to season 2.
I do appreciate when they try, if you're, like, not so great with conserving your bullets, and you need something really fast.
Yeah.
Like, one thing I liked was, like, the RE4, RE5 mechanic, was, like, if you shoot something, you can melee it.
That was the best.
I think that's a bit more better. I don't know, I haven't used a melee attack much in this game, have you?
I used it a bit in Mass Effect 2, just because this is kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think its utility varies wildly depending on which character class you choose. And so, you know, your physically weaker character classes where you're using like biotics or tech abilities aren't going to get a lot of mileage out of the melee. And your assault soldier type classes that have a wider range of rapid fire weapons won't get a lot out of it. Hmm. But because I was the Vanguard, you don't get a lot of shots from a shotgun before you have to reload. Mm-hmm. So I would find myself with some regularity emptying the shotgun, and an enemy would still have a little bit of health left. So I'd go up and smack him with the shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
So I did get a little bit of use out of it. It is enhanced here because they integrate it, and I think I forgot to put this in the notes, full disclosure, but they integrate it with a little bit of a stealth element, where if mm-hmm. you can stealth up on an enemy from behind, you can hit them with the charged melee attack, and it'll take them out instantly.
Mm-hmm.
It has a little bit more utility here, but definitionally cover-based shooters aren't going to have a lot of use for getting up in your enemy's faces.
The enemy AI is significantly improved, which to me is a big plus, just because, again, I just felt like I was shooting a bunch of really mindless creatures in the second game and the first game, to mm-hmm. be honest. It's not particularly interesting.
Yeah.
And some of these games perform a flashy one-hit kill if they're near Shepard.
Yeah, watch out.
A la, again, there's an Evil series, or I don't know. Take your pick. But either way, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, you know what's funny is this came out the same year as Resident Evil 6.
Mm.
It's hard not to wonder if Mass Effect was taking some cues from, like, Resident Evil 5, which had come out in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's too early for this. Maybe it's more Gears of War that we're getting influences from here. I didn't see in any of the interviews that I read where they were specifically citing games that influenced the more shooter oriented direction of Mass Effect 3, but mm-hmm. it's hard to imagine Gears of War not being a part of the conversation.
Sure. Like, it does feel like the era of, like, third-person shooters.
Yeah, this was because, you know, you had, what was it, like, the 90s were platformers,
mm-hmm.
the early 2000s, I don't know what they were, but the late 2000s to early 2010s were shooters,
mm-hmm.
and then from like the mid 2010s to the early 2020s were open world RPGs. That was like the default. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now like online team based shooters are the the default.
Marvel Rivals, yeah, all that kind of good stuff.
How, like, every decade has like a default genre. So mm-hmm. Mass Effect 3 is just kind of a good example of the zeitgeist that was going on in the early 2010s, where everything kind of needed to be a shooter of some stripe.
Exactly.
It was a dark era for RPGs. I'll be eternally grateful that, like, turn-based RPGs came back in the mid-2010s
mm-hmm.
and haven't ever left us again.
Yeah.
But boy howdy, we were starved for traditional RPGs from, like, 05 to 15 or so.
Speaking of good things, grenades are back in this game.
Yeah, grenades.
Yeah. In the second one, they are just more of an ability for certain classes, which I personally never found a use for. It's like they had like the flashbang grenade. I didn't find them particularly useful. I don't even know if the computer like registered that you were throwing it.
Yeah, why are you going to bother blinding enemies when they just run towards you anyway? You know,
they always did. It never seemed to work.
Interact well with the AI.
No. In this game, class impacts what type of grenade you have access to. You can have a regular, for example, incendiary, cluster, etc.
Mm-hmm.
They are a consumable resource, so you do have to kind of watch your back.
Yeah, you have to like reload them occasionally.
Yeah, in like ME2, like, didn't you just automatically get more?
Right, exactly, because they were an ability, they were on your ability wheel, they just charged like every other ability.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Mass Effect 1 and this, they have their own kind of consumable ammo.
Yeah. There's ability combos, so certain abilities can be chained together into more powerful combo attacks.
Mm-hmm.
Using an ability in some way that manipulates space.
Yeah, so, like, you put the enemy into a warp or a singularity to set up the combo.
Mm-hmm.
And then detonation is the next step.
Yeah. Which is always my favorite. Using a damage-based ability or grenade. Like ME1, or sorry, ME2. You have a cryo explosion, cluster grenade, etc.
Hamilton, did you know that you could do this combo thing in Mass Effect 2?
No.
Neither did I!
when I knew that you could do combos in this game, I was just like, oh, that's a nice addition to this third entry to the series. You could do that in the second game?
You know, so it was much more limited. Yeah, what I was reading was that you could do it with warp specifically. Like, and I think that's the thing that like melts armor or something. So it makes sense that it would be a like a combo kind of thing. But apparently you could do these combos in Mass Effect 2 with warp. And I never did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's much more expanded now.
Yeah, let's just say it. Like, it does make sense because there were, I forgot, was it like stasis or whatever? We could like stop enemies in their tracks and then like use your cryo bomb.
cryo bomb. That's when a bomb makes you really sad.
It does. It makes you cry a lot. classes. So similar to the first two games, you can decide on what new class you want to start with.
Yeah, unlike Mass Effect 2, there's no real narrative justification for why you would have changed between the two. Like with Mass Effect 2, Shepard gets rebuilt, so it makes sense that you could change your character class. But if you've imported a Shepard from Mass Effect 2 here, it is a little bit funny that, you know, they could go from being like a soldier in Mass Effect 2 to like, oh, now I have biotics.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't bother to explain it, and they really didn't need to.
Right. Classes determine stats like HP and damage, weight capacity, and your unique abilities.
Mm-hmm.
So the weight capacity replaces weapon specialization from Mass Effect 2.
Like in that one, every class could only access certain weapons.
Yeah. Which I was like, I get it, but it's also kind of like, because sometimes I think my class, I could have like a pistol and a sniper rifle.
Yeah.
And that was kind of like it. So you did like kind of one adventure force, but in this one, you can just kind of equip anything.
Mm-hmm.
Which also makes sense. They have weight values. So like, I mean, yeah, if you're your sorcerer probably can't handle like a grenade launcher. But they should still be able to handle other things like a machine gun. So I respect that. Equipping too much weight makes your special abilities recharge slower.
Yeah, I think this is really elegant. This is a way to reinforce that more. As you were getting at, kind of Dungeons & Dragons conception of character classes, where, like, sure, a magician could equip heavy armor, but the trade-off is they're not going to be able to use all of their magic as effectively.
Exactly.
Whereas, like, a fighter can, you know, equip everything and use it effectively, but the trade-off is they don't get access to those cool spells.
Exactly. So, I can appreciate the balance that takes for character classes.
Yeah.
So similar from Mass Effect 2, the skill tree.
Yeah.
Where you power up several abilities or stats using points from your level up, you know, RPG elements. But now they branch earlier than they did in ME2.
Right.
And ME2 was a bit of a, I mean, I respected that there's like, I think like three levels of like the regular level up. And then the fourth one, you get like a unique ability.
Yeah. And then they branch right at the end.
They like branch at the only end, at the end.
You can choose one of two. Yeah.
So in this one, it gives you a bit more versatility with like upgrading your abilities. So that's kind of nice.
Yeah. It makes the characters more differentiated from each other, which is pretty cool too.
Multiplayer, Galaxy at War. Now I have not touched the multiplayer.
This is really odd. The reason why you haven't touched the multiplayer, Hamilton, is because it's not present in the Legendary Edition.
Okay, well, that would be why.
This no longer exists. Yeah, this was, and I can address this if you want me to real quick.
Oh, go for it, yes.
This was kind of a standard online third-person shooter deathmatch. There were, like, teams and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like we were talking about, very common in the late 2000s and early 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
It includes microtransactions to acquire in-game currency.
Yikes.
So you could like get new character classes or weapons or stuff. Like, don't need that.
Mm-hmm.
And the cool part of it was that you could play as lots of different in-game races, because obviously in the main campaign, you're locked to playing a human. But here you could play as an Asari or a Krogan.
Mm-hmm.
I think Lily said that you could play as, oh Lord, what's that silly little kind of squishy dumpy race?
Well,
that wear like the breathing masks.
The little pudgy, like little mole people looking little people.
Yeah, the mole people. What the heck are they called?
I don't remember, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Volus.
Mm-hmm.
You could play as a Volus.
Mm-hmm.
So there, yeah, that was pretty neat. And each one has different abilities that are unique to that character species.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd never get to see, like, Krogans can charge, which I guess is similar to the Vanguard attack, but, you know, a little unique.
Mm-hmm.
You'd level up as you completed matches, and you could get new equipment, customize your character with unique armor and weapons and so forth, and get better as you played.
Mm-hmm.
The weirdest part about this is that your performance in multiplayer matches would actually impact the ending that you got in the single player game.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't required. It would just make it more likely that you would get the good ending. Well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes with the Galactic Readiness System, but it did irritate me a little bit when this came out that
mm-hmm.
you theoretically had to like work harder in the single player game to get a good ending if you didn't play the multiplayer content, which I didn't,
mm-hmm.
because I do not need to be called slurs over the internet by a 12-year-old.
Exactly.
The other weird quirk here, and I think I want to say you can read more about this in Jason Schreier's book. Shoot, I don't remember the name of the book now, but it was a book that journalist Jason Schreier wrote where he talked about various development processes at game studios in the 2010s.
Mm-hmm.
Galaxy at War, this multiplayer mode, could only be accessed with a new copy of Mass Effect 3, where you'd get it for free,
mm-hmm.
or by paying separately to access it if you bought a used copy or rented the game. And that was part of a wider, in my opinion, rather sinister strategy at EA during the early 2010s, where they were trying to discourage used game sales and rentals because they didn't make money on those.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, all that's to say that they stripped everything about this out in the Legendary Edition. As far as I can tell, I probably should have done some more reading about it. You know, maybe it's hidden away in some menu or something.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I could tell, the multiplayer is just not there. It's just not a part of the Legendary Edition.
It doesn't sound like we're super missing anything.
No, I think it had, like, very dedicated fans.
Yeah.
You know, I seem to recall when the Legendary Edition came out, some folks being bummed that they couldn't play the online multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
And I can dig it. You know, it's not my cup of tea. I think
mm-hmm.
the Uncharted multiplayer was similar, where you're like, Uncharted? Why would that have a multiplayer mode? But some people really dug it.
Also, there's a Kinect version of this?
Oh my goodness, can you believe it? Again, like, peak early 2010s.
I mean, it makes sense based on the time, but oh my goodness.
Yeah, I've never used a Kinect.
I used one, but it wasn't mine, because back in the day, somehow, a bunch of us had 360s, Xbox 360s.
That was the time. Yeah, I had one too.
That was the time, because that's when I had the Gears of War and everything like that.
Right.
But it's a motion and voice tracking device that Microsoft added to the 360 and the Xbox One to compete with the Nintendo Wii.
I guess they were trying to get the Xbox into retirement homes like the Wii was. I don't know.
We can't speak for everybody, but if it comes to the Kinect. When I used it, it was pretty buggy.
I've never heard a good thing about it.
Yeah, I did not enjoy using it. I think my friend, he used it all of like a few times and was done with it.
Mm-hmm.
In the third game, you can shout commands at squad mates using your Kinect. Why would I want to do that?
It feels like a really limited use case. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to press a button that works reliably every time. I'd rather shout into this microphone that misunderstands me at least a third of the time that I do it.
Yeah, it was not a great thing, at least for me.
I play games to not talk to people, you know? Right? Why would I inflict that on myself?
But fascinating that they added it. Okay, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Galactic Readiness. It's a rating that determines how well Shepard can perform against the Reaper threat at the end of ME3's story.
Mm-hmm.
It's impacted by a lot of things, in-game and out, like your story missions, right. Your side quests, Galaxy at War.
Yeah, the multiplayer mode.
Oh my goodness, what is this? The iOS game Mass Effect Infiltrator.
Yeah, everybody's favorite Mass Effect spinoff.
Yeah, couldn't get enough of this one. And a correspondence app called Mass Effect 3 Datapad. It sounds like Mario said, or like Mario Writes or whatever that game was. What is this?
Yeah, Mario teaches typing.
Mario teaches something that lets you get messages from in-game characters on your mobile device. Okay.
Can you imagine just, you know, you're going into your office, you're driving in, you get a notification on your phone, you get to your office and you pick it up
mm-hmm.
and you see Liara has written to you about the state of galactic readiness.
I was like, okay.
Like, I don't want notifications from real people on my phone.
Exactly.
I don't know. Again, it was a different time. It was a different time, I guess. But I do remember thinking back then, I was like, what's all this crap? You know, like, I'm just trying to play through a fun RPG. I don't want to be shouted at by people on the internet.
Right.
I don't want to play weird, like, rinky-dink mobile apps.
Right. But going back, you also didn't need to engage with the multiplayer or a Galaxy at War to get a good ending. Which I can appreciate. And Chris mentions here that he didn't when he originally played the game.
Yeah, I didn't do any of this extra junk.
It does sound like this Legendary Edition will be the most palpable version of this.
Yeah, that's true. They fixed a lot of this, is my understanding, in the Legendary Edition. I haven't gotten far enough in to see how they got rid of all of this weird cruft, but my understanding is that they did. Mm-hmm. It's just the Legendary Edition presents a concise, complete version of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So thank goodness for that. Before we tackle the events of Mass Effect 3 in next month's episode, we thought that it would be a good idea to bridge the plots of Mass Effect 2 and 3 with a piece of DLC that was released for Mass Effect 2 called Arrival. I can't stress enough that I did not play this the first time that I played through the series way back in the early 2010s, and the opening of Mass Effect 3 is nigh incoherent. If you haven't played this DLC, I was just baffled as to why, like, Shepard's on trial and everything. So this ends up being kind of a prologue to that game, weirdly enough, even though it is DLC for the preceding game.
Mm-hmm.
So this doesn't feature any companion characters. We just play as Shepard here. They get a request from Admiral Hackett to break a person named Dr. Amanda Kenson out of a Batarian prison. And for folks who don't remember, Batarians are these four-eyed humanoid aliens who tend to be pretty grouchy and anti-human. They're always giving you grief. Mm-hmm. Ugh, Shepard, get out of here, etc. So we have reason to kind of dislike the Batarians, but they're doing their own thing, too. They have reason to dislike humans. It's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
So we arrive at the Batarian prison on the planet Eritot in the Bahak system to sneak in and free Kenson. The environment here is pretty unremarkable. It's just like Mass Effect 2.jpg. It's, you know, prefab hallways. We get to crawl through some vents. It presents itself as a stealth mission, but Mass Effect 2 doesn't really have a stealth system. So what that equates to is that you usually get like a preemptive shot in on Batarian guards when you encounter them, and then it's just a normal firefight. There are a handful of environmental puzzles here, which include deactivating and reactivating these fiery gas vents. Again, not, you know, not rocket science stuff. There's like three vents and you kind of have to enable them and disable them in a certain order to get through an area. And this introductory section wraps up where we find a Batarian torturing Dr. Kenson in an interrogation room. And we take that Batarian out and help her escape. So this starts the second act of the DLC, where we go back through the facility and indeed some new areas, and we have to Dr. Kenson comes with us. So we do have a teammate here, but she's got very basic biotic powers and a pistol. She's not going to do any heavy lifting. Mostly we have to hold off waves of Batarians while she secures an escape elevator to a shuttle and gets us off of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So this leads to the third act of the DLC. And this is very short. You know, I'm breaking it up like it's an epic adventure, but all in all, it's about 90 minutes of game time. So we travel to a nearby asteroid on this shuttle, and Dr. Kenson fills us in on her backstory. She and a team of humans discovered a Reaper artifact called Rho, like the Greek letter, and they learned from the artifact that the Reapers are planning to use the mass relay, mass relay Alpha in the Batarian system to stage their invasion of the Milky Way galaxy. Consequently, Kenson realized that the only way that they could slow that Reaper invasion was destroying Mass Relay Alpha. This wouldn't, of course, halt the Reaper threat, but would give the galaxy dramatically more time to prepare for it. Otherwise, the Reapers get to this Mass Relay and are immediately everywhere all over Council space, ripping it apart. So their plan was to slam an asteroid into the relay, destroying it, with the unfortunate consequence of killing every Batarian who lives in that system. So we're on that shuttle. We find out Kenson's deal, and she and Shepard arrive at Kenson's base, which is called the Project. That base, the Project, is a little outpost that is affixed to the asteroid that they were trying to use as a weapon. They have put all of these like propulsion things on the asteroid. So they were planning to set that all up and then evacuate the base once the asteroid was on its way to the mass relay. So Kenson shows us to the Reaper artifact, which Shepard notes with some alarm has been left unsecured in a cargo bay. It's just like some kind of, I mean, it's like the artifacts that we encountered in Mass Effect 1, where you'd, you know, touch them and get visions and everything. Mm-hmm. But, you know, those were hidden underground and stuff. This one's just like sitting out in the middle of an office complex.
Just relaxing.
Yeah. So Shepard is justifiably worried that given how Reapers work, this has probably indoctrinated everybody who's been anywhere near it. And we immediately discover that that's true when Kenson locks us in the room and orders her crew to kill us so that we aren't able to stop the invasion of the Reapers.
Mm-hmm.
So we get beaten up. Shepard is sedated for 2 days and wakes up with only hours on this omnipresent clock throughout the base that shows when the Reapers are going to arrive. We break out of the sick bay by using a nearby terminal to briefly control a mech and kill our captors. This is really cool, and this is not expanded upon, but you use like a computer and then you're inhabiting the body of one of those goofy like Star Wars droid guys that's always going around and trying to shoot you in the main game.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember this ever coming up outside of this.
I don't think so.
The funny thing was, I don't know how long you can control this mech, because when I played this sequence, you're supposed to blow up this power supply that is powering the shield that keeps you stuck in the med bay. And I walked right up to it and blew it up from about a foot away, which destroyed the mech as well. So I don't know if you play more intelligently, maybe you can continue piloting the mech, but it was, you know, that was the end of the mech.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get out, we fight through the base. We battle human troops and mechs, more of those guys, as we activate the propulsion mechanism that's going to drive the asteroid into the mass relay. One detail here that I find really interesting is that for a series that hinges so much on player choice, we are not given the choice about whether to crash the asteroid into the relay or not. It just happens in a cutscene where Shepard decides that it's too important not to do, which absolves us as the player from slaughtering a system full of Batarians, but feels a little unsatisfying for me. Since I would have preferred that when Mass Effect 3 starts and we're on trial for doing this, there's a bit more heft if the player chose to do it. And instead, it's the only outcome available.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's too pivotal for the player not to, you know, for Shepard not to have done it. Because what the heck would Mass Effect 3 start with?
Mm-hmm.
If Shepard's just like, nah, never mind.
We're just gonna let it happen.
And then the Reapers appear. Anyway. Once we activate that, Kenson tries to stop us. She's planning to self-destruct the entire base and destroy the asteroid, which would kill her and us and everybody on the base, but would prevent the asteroid from striking the mass relay. So obviously we have to stop her from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
We get a dialogue sequence with her where she's holding the little self-destruct button, and we can choose to shoot her with a renegade prompt. I don't know what happens if you don't do that, because I was like, oh, good heavens. And so I shot her the second I had the chance while she's monologuing.
I did the same.
Yeah, it is weird, though, because she still activates the self-destruct mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how this was supposed to stop the asteroid from hitting the relay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to blame it on sloppy writing, because I probably just missed some key piece of information. So anyway, this wraps up with us racing to the surface of the base to call the Normandy and escape. And then once we're on the Normandy, we see the cutscene where the asteroid collides with the mass relay Alpha and results in a catastrophic explosion that wipes out all nearby life. Back on the Normandy, we are in the med bay there, meeting with Admiral Hackett, who has been kind of a perennial dude in the background throughout these games. And he tells us that we are personally responsible for over 300,000 Batarian deaths. A lot of blood on Shepard's hands for this. Of course, as Shepard points out, that saved trillions of lives mm-hmm. of everybody else in the galaxy. So it's a real, I guess you'd call it a trolley problem, right?
Tough. I mean, yeah, it's a hard choice for sure.
So unfortunately, this means that Earth's government is going to haul Shepard into prison. Because the humans don't want a war with the Batarians when they know that the Reapers are approaching the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
And even though Hackett believes our story, he's on our side, we're still going to have to face trial on Earth for wiping out an entire system's worth of people.
Mm-hmm.
That is the end of this DLC, which will lead us right into Mass Effect 3. And that's that for our first episode on Mass Effect 3. We hope you've enjoyed the show, and encourage you to let us know what you think, positive or negative, by emailing us at franchisefestival@gmail.com, or contacting us directly through our website at patreon.com/franchisefestival. Next time, we're going to be moving right along to the plot of Mass Effect 3, getting started with that trial on Earth. Once again, we've been your hosts, Chris.
And I'm Hamilton.
Thanks for listening, folks. Goodbye.